Okay. Erwin, any points you wish to discuss?
With the development of extra perceptions, there are a person feel past life karma directly using psychic energy.
With the development of extra perception, can you
heal past karma?
No. But you can, you can heal past life karma without clairvoyance. We just assume that we've created every negative karma, and so when one's doing a purification practice like prostration, 35 Buddhas and so on, you mentally go through, the five heinous actions, the five close to heinous actions, the five, the 10 non-virtuous actions, and mentally you presume you've created them all, and in the visualization of purification and so on, then you will actually, even though you can't specifically remember, that practice will definitely contribute towards purification of past life karma. If you do have clairvoyance, seeing past lives, and you are aware of specific acts, specific negative karmas, then that would certainly, I would imagine, be strong motivation to engage in even strong purification, stronger purification. So it would help from that point of view. But you don't need it anyway.
You'd be carrying it in this life.
Sorry?
You would be carrying it in this life. It would have manifested.
Yes, whichever karmic propensities haven't brought forth the result are still alive. Like they never fade away from their own side, life after life. They're born on the mere eye, the merely imputed eye, which goes from life to life. What? That doesn't raise any questions.
Merely imputed eye. Well, I'm thinking that
is the bare. Say.
I'm thinking that's the one I think is here now, because it's intuitive. You know, Kala is sitting here. Your consciousness is a bit
diverse from
life to life.
No, Kala is just the person of this life. She's a merely imputed Kala.
Yeah, I know.
Of this life.
I think I am,
I think we all think we are. What's what? Well, it's that is the eye that exists. Well, that's the eye that goes from life to life. Because, you see, it's the mere eye is merely imputed upon what? The body and mind. Right? The combination of body and mind. That's at a gross level. But our body, our gross body and mind are changing, baby, adolescent, adult, etc. And at death, the gross body and the gross mind cease, and the continuum is just the mere, the clear light mind, and supported by the clear light wind, which is still present in our heart chakra, and that is what leaves this body and takes or forms the bardo body and then enters the womb, a womb rebirth of the future life. So the final basis of imputation of the mere eye is the what we call the eternal drop, this entity which is the combination of clear light wind and clear light mind. So the Miriam, so that's the basis of imputation. That's not the I, but it's the basis of imputation of I. So whatever the I is, that is the bearer of karmic propensities, whatever the merely imputed I. Only in potential form. You know, the mental aggregates are present but very subtle. We don't normally call the clear light wind the body aggregate, but the potential for body aggregate is there. There does need to be a physical support for mind. Well, what about Tantra? This eternal drop, which is a single entity. So mind, even in the formless realm, because it's not mentioned in the sutras because they don't even talk about the subtle wind, which is the support of mind. So it's called formless. But the mind of the formless being has no gross body, but it is supported by most subtle wind. Yeah, you don't call that the body aggregate. You just say they have four aggregates of mind. Anyway. Yeah, Helen.
When he's talking about the extra perception, that if you have extra perception and you act on that extra perception in a compassionate way, it's far more powerful. So I think we all do that at times with our even our undeveloped intuition. So if I'm with a person who, I'm picking up some sort of pain or misery or whatever, and I'm intuiting, and they're not saying, but I'm intuiting, and I feel that I can help them with that particular pain, they use the word me, that feels like a more powerful act than just the general act of giving food,
giving
clothes, or
giving shelter. Yeah, sure. Of course. In just our everyday intelligence, we can guess the dispositions and the needs of particular individuals and act in a, you know, a helpful way accordingly.
Yeah.
For sure, that happens. That's not the... this clairvoyance, but it's similar.
It is similar. I thought it was like a basis of
it. Well, the thing is that the extra awareness, or this heightened awareness of knowing others' minds, means you really know.
You know,
like we can, in our intuition, we may not be exactly correct. And we may even have an intuition of where they're at, but we choose the wrong way of trying to help, and we get rebuffed, and we get aggression, because we don't know exactly the right way. I think if you have this clairvoyance, you know exactly what to do and how to help without making a mistake. So it's huge. And for all the sentient beings that you come across, you have that awareness. So it's unbelievably, yeah, as I say, it enhances one's power to accumulate merit, because you get right to the point of what sentient beings need from that. But yeah, you're right. Through our general intelligence, we can gain a rough idea.
Yeah.
of where people's minds are at and what to say or what not to say.
And people feed you with cues as well.
Sorry?
People feed us with personal cues. So if we become observant, those cues are our way in to helping.
Views.
No, cues. C-U-E-S.
Body language, voice language,
even looking away or not looking away.
I agree, definitely we and our sensitivity I think would increase the more our compassion increases and wisdom.
And I think just on that my mind really started rolling with you as you were talking about it. And I think that often we don't respond to that intuition because we worry about not being right, or we get really overwhelmed sometimes. Oh, maybe I'll say the wrong thing, do the wrong thing.
But yeah, sure.
You get feedback on it.
Yeah.
You get fast feedback if you're going down the wrong road.
Yeah, definitely. That's the point why we should try and cultivate the actual clairvoyance, which is not mistaken and knows.
It would be amazing to have that feeling.
What do you think some people are born with?
What?
Why are some people born with it? They may not necessarily be very
karmically, a result of karma, not as a result of karma abiding, but as a result of karma, one can have a heightened sensitivity, and they call themselves clairvoyants, and some don't even have it at all and they still call themselves clairvoyants, make lots of money. But karmically you can have flashes of insight. I remember Yeshu back in the 70s telling us about doing retreats. After a long retreat, you can have flashes of being able to see what's going on. My famous flash was, did a 6 weeks Manjushri retreat with Thupten Sherden and Helmut at Copan. A very isolated, no news. And at the end of the retreat, we came out having lunch, and Marcel, he was bunk at that stage, he says, "You'll never guess what happened while you're in retreat." And a lot can happen in the world in 6 weeks. And I just spontaneously came out and said, "Elvis Presley died." Yes, that's what he's going to tell me. So I had no hint, or somehow that just came into my mind. So that was a flash. That was not heightened awareness. Well, that's what Lama Yeshu was saying. He said, after strong retreat, you can get flashes like that. But that's not the clairvoyance.
No, I'll tell you all the flashes. It's
not even anything? I'm on to verse 31. Well, the three forms of morality, or three forms of ethics, is that?
Divided it into three, and the one that I remember is or the one that was clear to me was the one where if you're going to provide someone with food, you don't steal food. That was
that's
one. That was one. Doesn't matter. I'll form the question better for tomorrow.
The second book conduct. And the first one was not the following nine virtues. The second one was guard against ethical conduct when doing virtue. The third one was that one. Guard against ethical conduct when working for the benefit of others.
Yes. Yeah. And I just, to me, I couldn't quite differentiate them, but I'll get to those and maybe think about
it. But there's also the split up with morality, with keeping vows and.
Well, in the next verse, the three forms of ethics, right?
Yeah.
So that's the three ways of practicing morality. So the first is the morality of restraint, restraining from non-virtue, which means taking vows.
Yeah.
Then there's a morality of accumulating virtue, the body, speech and mind,
yeah,
collecting virtue, you know, and then there's a morality of working for others. Without any non-virtuous contamination of helping others. So that may have been where he talked about the food. I've had no instruction on that, but I would imagine that you meditate on the generality of impermanence, of how the phenomenon of impermanence covers all phenomena that arise from causes and conditions. You know, moment by moment change. So the generality of how that phenomenon exists. And you would get my feeling is that you would have a meaning generality, a mental image of impermanence. And that's what you would meditate on. I don't think you would meditate on the subtle moment by moment change of an ice cream, or I think it would just be the fact of impermanence. I've had no instruction of how you attain come abiding by meditating on impermanence, but that was how I would imagine. Any?
Well, how I would think is it's a thing phenomena, so you would have to get it through reasoning, and then you would have a conceptual, you would have an inference, right, which is a conceptual realization.
Yeah.
So it would have to be a mental image.
Yeah.
And
what's the nature of that inference? So you're analysing first.
Yeah, you're trying to establish the object of impermanence. Yeah. You get that through reason until that object appears. And then once you're familiar with that, then you bring that to mind and you go to the point.
So you could say, well, I've got this car now, and this car is 30 years past. There it is, it's changed.
It's the same as meditating on emptiness. You meditate on your conceptual understanding of emptiness, which actually isn't emptiness. It's your mental image of emptiness. And this is the whole point about breaking through the conceptual into the direct awareness where your mental consciousness sees emptiness without a conceptual image. It sees it directly. And only that has the power.
My feeling is that if you really saw emptiness, I think it's but my feeling is that you would see that everything is one and it's not all separated.
Heresy. Heresy.
No.
No.
Everything dies, everything goes back to the earth and comes back to...
Ashes to ashes, dust to dust. That's in another book. Yeah, that's right. And same with emptiness. Anyway, I think what Ishi said is makes it clear. Otherwise, you're just speculating. You want to ask again, like, how does one gain calm abiding by meditating on the object impermanence? I think Yeshi is right, but if you're still not sure, ask Enla. You can attain calm abiding by meditating on the Four Noble Truths. In fact, the Vibha seekers, you only meditate on impermanence because they say, I think, permanent objects cannot appear to mental consciousness or to mind.
Permanent objects cannot appear to
mental consciousness. Yeah, so they say you achieve the path of seeing by meditating on impermanence, not on emptiness, because emptiness doesn't appear to mind. You only realize emptiness indirectly after realizing directly impermanence. Yeah.
I was just wondering about the process of developing non-conceptual meditation and the experience of that, if it's conceptually like trying to blow dust out the way or trying to wash a window to see through the window. So it's constant almost just trying to, obviously it is, but trying to break through the clouds to the sky. So it's kind of a bit of a struggle, I guess. I just wonder about the experience of.
Well, I mean, I've had no experience, but the way it's described is that you gain karma abiding on a mental image of, say, emptiness. So it's intellectual understanding, still karma abiding, and then.
It might be just a
personal understanding.
Personal understanding.
Sorry?
You could have it wrong.
No, then you can't go any further. You have a correct conceptual understanding. You've got to have a correct conceptual understanding. And you can come right, and then you accumulate merit and so on, you're on the path, and more and more merit, more and more powerful power of concentration. And finally, when you've accumulated enough merit and power of concentration, you enter the session, and you begin by meditating on your mental image of emptiness, and then through the power of your mind. It says it changes so that all duality disappears, so there's gross duality and subtle duality. There's a duality of thinking I am realizing emptiness, aware of the subject and the object of being separate. There's a duality induced by the confusing your conception of emptiness to the actual emptiness. And so when all of this non-duality is said to be like the mind and the object are undifferentiable, like clear water poured into clear water. So that occurs as a result of the great accumulation of merit and power of concentration when you're ready.
That's very helpful, thank you.
And that's more to do with the realization of emptiness than the attainment of karma abiding.
Yeah, that's based upon karma abiding. Not just karma, but the higher insight, vipassana.
This conversation is sort of mixed with.
Sorry?
This conversation is sort of split. We've got how to realize emptiness and then how to develop karma abiding.
Well, no, I mean, we just assumed one has. You have to have generated karma abiding and then vipassana, higher seeing. And they're unified, so that the subjective mind realizing emptiness is a unification of karma abiding and higher seeing. Initially, the higher seeing, its referent object is seen conceptually, but then you break through and it's seen non-conceptually, the object. As it's got nothing to do with Kundalini Yoga. Well, Kundalini Yoga is Hindu practice, it's not Buddhist.
I know, but they will, in some way, land up in the same spot.
I have no idea what Kundalini Yoga is. They don't achieve the direct awareness of emptiness because they don't have a presentation of emptiness in their tenets. So they don't achieve the path of seeing. That can only be achieved in dependence upon a correct understanding of emptiness. Do the Hindu meditators achieve direct non-conceptual awareness of the particular object that they're meditating on? What do you think? Of their object that they're meditating, Kundalini, whatever it is.
Kundalini is when you rise, you go through all your channels, and you purify all your channels, and you send the, I don't know, satisfied like a white dot. And then when you get to the top, here you have bliss.
Well, I don't know. Again, we're just speculating. I don't know. Yeah.
Is emptiness sometimes referred to as phenomena?
As phenomena? Don't think so. It is a phenomenon, but the term phenomena includes all things. In philosophy, I know it has a specific meaning, but when we use the term phenomenon, it means something which exists, can be known by mind.
But my understanding of phenomena is everything is phenomenal.
Sorry?
My understanding of phenomena is that everything is phenomenal, even subtle.
Well, whatever exists is a phenomenon, and collectively they're phenomena. I mean, but do you think there's something special about the term?
It's something that I use personally.
Well, yeah, but I'm just saying in Buddhism, the way we have adopted the word phenomenon, I know it has a specific meaning in philosophy, but I can't remember what it is. It's phenomena and noumena. But we use the term phenomenon to include whatever is a phenomenon is something which exists and is knowable by mind.
It's intuitive.
Huh?
It's intuitive.
Our computers are dumb. They don't know nothing.
It's imputed.
Whatever exists is merely imputed.
The whole phenomenon is imputed.
Whatever phenomenon exists, it exists through mere imputation upon a basis.
Yeah.
A correct basis. Although, this one Galupa Lama, who says, Lama Tsongkhapa said nothing about a correct basis. Alan Moles' guru, Alan Moles' book, Realizing Emptiness, it's one of his teachers. Like our teachers always say, things exist through mere imputation upon a valid basis. And Geshe somebody, who Alan Moles has translated his teachings, says, no, Lama Tsongkhapa didn't say anything about a valid basis. Probably Genla Rinpoche. Yeah. Because as soon as you mention valid basis, you're dangerously close to inherent existence, which is a reasonable objection. Dangerously close. Anyway. Yeah, well, that's right. It's something which is suitable, conventionally suitable, to impute elephant on something that we all know is suitable to be called an elephant, and it's not a kangaroo.
Yeah. I don't see how that implies anything. Just common sense, like we have this common understanding of a shape or a sound.
Yeah, but the trouble is, even we know that, the thing suitable to be called an elephant still appears to our mind as an inherently existing elephant. And we grasp at that to be true. That's the trouble.
Or you could say, but the base is there, isn't it? The base is actually there, from its own side. That could crop up. So the
elephant's
not inherently existent, but it's labelled upon a base which is there.
Where? Which part of that animal is the base that Suda would be called elephant? I mean, you can't even find the base if you...
It's a trunk, isn't it?
Can I just ask, what are some of the qualities of emptiness?
Sorry?
What are some of the qualities of emptiness?
Qualities of emptiness. Qualities of emptiness.
Or what are some of the things out there that are not the qualities? Just
it's empty.
Well, every phenomenon, right, going back to phenomena, every phenomenon has two natures. It has a conventional nature and an ultimate nature. The ultimate nature is emptiness. It's emptiness of inherent existence. And the conventional nature is, well, you know, whatever particular function, if it's an impermanent phenomenon, whatever specific function it performs, you could say that. It's whatever way it can be described according to sensory observation. They're the conventional aspect. So a vase conventionally, its definition of a vase is a flat bottomed water container, a wide bellied flat bottomed water container. And its ultimate nature is empty of existing inherently as a wide-bellied, flat-bottomed water container. Emptiness is the ultimate nature of things, and its quality is the absence, mere absence of inherent existence. It has a permanent nature. It's something which doesn't change moment by moment. Mere means there is nothing existing from its own side.
That's what it means in this context.
Yeah, sometimes people can think emptiness exists inherently. But merely imputed means there is no existence whatsoever from its own side. Merely imputed. So it's the imputation. Yeah, it's the imputation which establishes things to exist. Things exist in dependence upon imputation.
So things exist for us independent of our imputation.
So?
Things exist for us.
For us.
Independent of our imputation, correct? What we see is what we think it is.
It's not our thinking which establishes what we see. The appearance of inherent existence is in our mind, and that's what we grasp that to be true. Say?
For some period of time, it usually is. You buy these red tables because you reckon they're going to last for a while. And function is a red table.
So what you're saying, that the appearance of a red table as inherently existing is correct because it lasts over time.
No, I'm saying some period of time, then what you've imputed on that table, it actually functions that way. You want that there so people can sit down and write on it.
But you can't impute elephants upon that table. It will never function as an elephant.
No. Well,
so
maybe.
You can see the table. So from your point of view, from here, if there is a table, if you go to that object and try and find the table, you won't find it.
But that's an intellectual exercise.
That's absolutely, you can't do it.
Is a red table red?
Well, that's because we all have one understanding of what red is. We all say that's red.
Is a red table red?
Okay. Is a red table red?
Unless you're colourblind and you see it's brown.
No, normal eyes.
Is a red table red? What is it?
No.
It's not.
Red is a colour.
Yes.
Is a table a colour?
Yes, but this is language.
So you come from a culture that's never seen a table.
Sir?
So you come from a culture that's never seen a table.
Yeah.
Your mind will know what it is.
But I bet you would use that footing,
don't you? You would never use your culture.
No, but you come from a culture that's never seen a table.
Yeah, well, that's
what would you see?
But what about the take a completely different culture, like an ant? An ant doesn't see that table, it sees it as a flat hill that you walk across, right? But he sees it in the same way, he sees it inherently like that. He's saying that at least it inherently is a table. And you might say conventionally we're both right, but ultimately we're both wrong.
Because that table may not have.
No, because it's a table from you looking at it and knowing the table.
Well, therefore it's a perception.
And from an ant, it's a flat hillside, you know.
Then again, we get back to perception. That's what
he said. Yeah. It doesn't appear that way. It appears like the table there without you doing anything about it. Without you knowing anything about it, it seems like the table is just over there by itself.
Anything about the teachings? It's inherently existing 5:00. Thank you.